Topic 1, Censorship of Obscenity, Part 2. This is Lynn Kastner, Executive Director of the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union. In Part 1 of our series on censorship of obscenity, we heard from John French, former clerk to the late Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter, discuss the U.S. Supreme Court standards on censorship of obscenity. This evening, we're going to hear from two persons, Gordon K. Haskell, National Director of Membership and Development for the American Civil Liberties Union, who will discuss the historical development of the American Civil Liberties Union position on censorship of obscenity. We will also hear from Professor Ed Gerald of the Journalism School of the University of Minnesota on leave this year, who will speak on censorship and will argue for a moderation of the American Civil Liberties Union viewpoint. On the next program, we will hear from Dr. Reynold Jensen, Director of Child Psychiatry at the University of Minnesota Hospitals and member of the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union Board, who will speak on the cause and effect relationship, if any, of reading materials alleged to be obscene and antisocial behavior, drawing from his 25 years' experience as a psychiatrist treating children at the university hospitals. Last week we discussed the American Civil Liberties Union position as well as the Supreme Court standards relating to censorship of obscenity. It was pointed out that in the Roth case in 1957, the U.S. Supreme Court stated that for a prosecution of obscenity, it must be shown that the dominant theme of the work, when taken as a whole, to the average person applying contemporary community standards, appeals to the prurient interest. And we discussed what the court set forth as the prurient interest in various cases and according to the views of the various justices. We pointed out that the Civil Liberties Union, the National Board of the Civil Liberties Union, has stated that a criminal prosecution should show beyond a reasonable doubt that there is a clear and present danger of antisocial conduct according to a valid criminal statute before a criminal prosecution can be sustained. This position was argued in the case of Jacobellis versus Ohio, as we also pointed out, is currently been argued in the Mishkin and Ginsburg cases now before the U.S. Supreme Court. We should know quite shortly whether the Supreme Court will re-examine its position in the Roth case or will give further guidelines to censorship or obscenity prosecutions. The ACLU urged that a strong set of due process protections should be applied in obscenity prosecutions, and that these should include a clear statutory definition of the offense, the right to counsel, the right to a prompt and fair public trial by jury, and the right to appeal. ACLU also stated that no action should be directed against persons who are without knowing and substantial responsibility for the creation or distribution of the material in question. Now, in the case of Jacobellis versus Ohio, the Supreme Court stated that contemporary community standards should be of national concern rather than applied to just a local area. And also in a recent case, the U.S. Supreme Court said that to sustain a criminal prosecution, the news dealer or distributor of the material should have knowledge of the materials before he can be prosecuted for distribution of these materials. ACLU pointed out that the protection of requiring knowledge or having a substantial responsibility for the distribution would remove pressures from the small candy store or bookstore operator who has nothing to do with the production of alleged material and place the responsibility on the author, publisher, or distributor of the questionable item. The ACLU said, quote, "The ordinary bookseller's fear that he may be prosecuted when he does not have finances for defense, and neither time nor competence to judge every book, results too frequently in his deciding not to stock controversial books at all, including many dealing with social and political problems. Thus, people who wish to exercise their right to read books of their own choice are denied access to the material," unquote. ACLU also urged that if prosecutors are considering court action against persons in connection with a book, magazine, painting, or other materials protected by the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, the alleged obscenity of the material first be determined before criminal proceedings are brought. Quote, ACLU said, "We prefer the use of in rem proceedings against material alleged to be obscene, with a right to defend the material being afforded the publisher, distributor, retailer, etc., as a prerequisite to any criminal prosecution of any person for publishing, distributing, or selling such material thereafter. Moreover, if an adverse determination is made in such a proceeding based on the exception concerning material aimed at children, the judgment should be limited to that target group so as not to affect other groups in subsequent proceedings. Also, 1, in any criminal prosecution, knowledge of any prior in rem finding of obscenity should be required. And 2, in any criminal prosecution following an in rem finding of obscenity, a new trial on the question of obscenity should be required. And finally, 3, any party involved in the issue should be permitted to reopen an in rem finding of obscenity after the passage of a reasonable period of time. The statute should define such a period as within 5 years, but should not bar subsequent action," unquote. We should point out that an in rem proceeding means a court proceeding directed not against the person, but against the book, or against the painting, or a magazine, or other literature, which is the subject of the prosecution. The court action proceeds actually against the material, and the hearing then is to whether or not that material is obscene, and not whether or not the distributor has committed a crime in circulating it. This issue was important in the recent case of the city versus the Lower Edge Gallery, and we'll discuss that in more detail in a later program. But just to amplify this point, the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union argued in its brief that the seizure of the painting was prior to a judicial determination that it was obscene, which is consistent with the standards set forth in the Supreme Court cases and in the ACLU position. It is our position, therefore, that no protected material can be removed from the open marketplace prior to a judicial determination, a hearing in court, in an adversary proceeding, that is, where a person has the right to a lawyer, to present witnesses, to cross-examine witnesses against him, which hearing determines, either in a criminal or civil hearing, that the material is obscene, and that prior to this, the material cannot be removed from the marketplace. We'll come back to this in greater detail, because the Brodigan case, the Lower Gallery case, has implications far beyond the individual painting. It involves a statute which allows the state of Minnesota to, or any of its officials, to issue a warrant to seize obscene materials, or allegedly obscene materials, issued by a judge. But this statute, it is our position, is unconstitutional. And the judge in the Brodigan case commented that from what he knows now, the statute is unconstitutional. We'll discuss this statute and Minnesota problems of obscenity in a later program. Before we hear from our speakers tonight, I'd like to remind the listening audience that if you would like to receive a brochure on censorship and obscenity, a statement of the American Civil Liberties Union position on this question, send your name and address to Minnesota Civil Liberties Union, 925 Upper Midwest Building, Minneapolis, Minnesota. We invite your comments and inquiries to Minnesota Civil Liberties Union, Upper Midwest Building, Minneapolis, Minnesota. And now Gordon K. Haskell, National Director of Development and Membership for the American Civil Liberties Union, speaks on the historical position or the historical development of the ACLU position on censorship and obscenity. Mr. Haskell.
I was asked to speak about the historic development of the present position of the American Civil Liberties Union on censorship of obscene material. I went to our files department in New York and asked for the history, and the history I got was only about 6 or 7 years old. And the reason for that, after doing a little bit of additional research, seems to be that it was not until a few years ago that the American Civil Liberties Union felt called upon to try to wrestle with the broad definitions about which we have just heard. The union, from the time it was founded in 1920, had taken the position that, of course, we will tolerate no political censorship, whatever, and had entered a number of the cases which were being brought to court with regard to censorship on grounds of sexual morality. But it had apparently taken the position that in each one of these cases, the material which was being offered for control did not fall within the definition of hardcore pornography. In other words, that there was socially redeeming importance in it, there was literary value, and that on these grounds, the material was protected by the First Amendment. That way of dealing with the issue, although it is satisfactory in the sense that you can enter each case as it arises through the courts and gets into national prominence, was felt to be inadequate about 5 years ago when we were reviewing the positions the union has been taking on a number of issues and came to this issue also. I think you will understand that this issue is one which is probably surrounded by more heat than any other, except perhaps the question of separation of church and state. Somehow, when we come to talk about morality, we get excited. And of course, it's very proper that people feel deeply about the ultimate sanctions, the ultimate values by which they try to live their lives and by which they would like to have society live its life. But the problem in this area is not the right of people to make choices, but the attempt to impose on the whole of society standards which I or you or a group of people may feel should be imposed on society. And in the area of censorship, we have the only field of law, as far as I know, in which we attempt to regulate by statute people's thoughts, not their actions, but their thoughts. There's no other area in which we say that to induce bad thoughts in people is criminal. You can think about murdering anybody you want to. You can think about making H-bombs and dropping them on people. Children regularly engage in fantasies of destroying their parents and others in authority, and sometimes we don't grow out of that stage and we keep on thinking along those lines. As long as that thought does not proceed to action, there is no area of law in which we attempt to inhibit it, except in this area of censorship of pornography, where the court standard in the Roth decision is that the government may prevent by putting people in prison or fining them or exercising other sanctions of them their publishing material which causes bad thoughts in others. And the union finally said it's not enough to argue case by case on the grounds of redeeming social value or literary value or what have you. We really ought to come to grips with this basic question. Is there anything that the government has the right to prohibit by law merely because it induces bad thoughts, thoughts which we would prefer people didn't think, and others? And we came to the conclusion that that should be completely outside of the realm of government authority. And therefore, the position which we adopted was that rather than our trying to add our bit of definition to the many which one may think of about hardcore pornography that we cannot define where the core hardens or softens in pornography. All we can define is what may be validly made illegal. And we came to the conclusion that what we would propose is that that may be made illegal, which can be shown to immediately result in criminal acts and acts which violate laws. Now, no one has thought of passing a law against your thinking bad thoughts. They just pass a law against somebody providing you with material which might be a basis of contemplation, which would produce these thoughts or what have you. But what we're saying is that the state has the right to prevent actions which are illegal, which are crimes, not to create a crime of publishing material, but to prevent antisocial acts of one citizen against another or of citizens against public authority. And if it can be shown that the particular material in question directly and immediately produces such antisocial acts, it may be validly prevented by state or government action. And that's where we stand now. Now, the additional question was asked, well, if you're saying, and we put this, to put it very precisely, if obscenity laws are invoked, prosecution should be based on clear proof that the material would cause, quote, an abnormal adult behavior which has validly been made criminal by statute, unquote. Now they said, well, that's all you're saying, a normal adult, but how about children? Isn't there a special protection to which our children are entitled by the government, since we as parents find it difficult to protect them in this particular area? Can't we ask the government at least to take that job off our overburdened parental shoulders and protect them from material? And the union said, well, if you can show that the material is aimed towards a specialized group, whether they be children or scholars, and that this material will induce in them, in this specialized group, illegal acts, not thoughts, then the state may properly regulate it. In other words, if the material is being distributed at the junior high school level, and that's where it's really aimed, then what one must show is not, again, that it will induce these children to think bad things, but that it will induce them to actually do things which are illegal. So similarly, for scholars, if you can show that the particular type of material will induce scholars to do things that are illegal, and otherwise the standards may vary with the group to which the material is directed if it can be shown that it's specially geared or specially directed to a particular group. There are some people who feel that our position is disingenuous. That is, that if we really believe that anything goes in the sense that nothing should be regulated in the realm of communication, by the government, unless it is immediate incitement to illegal activity, why don't we just say so? And just say that in the realm of sexual morality, the government has no right to regulate communication. They may regulate marriage and actions of one kind or another, but not communication. Rather than putting the standard, which is obviously very difficult for any court to abide by, it is very hard. Since all kinds of people disagree on what the cause and effect relationship is, to actually put on the prosecution the obligation to show that the act followed directly and immediately from the reading or the viewing is an almost impossible burden, and why don't we just come clean and say that we just don't think anything should be censored at all? I think there is some value in posing it this way, because I think it addresses itself to the concern of those who are pressing for censorship. It puts on them the obligation to meet our argument that before you can ask society to put people in prison or to confiscate material and burn it, you've got to really show that the evil which it may create or which it is likely to create is such as the state has the right to prevent. And if the evil is something that is in people's heads and that you wish weren't there, that may be of deep concern to you and me. but it cannot be a concern of society, of the government, to make it illegal and to put people in prison for instigating it or aiding in people having bad thoughts. That's the position of the ACLU. Of course, on the enforcement level, we have had many things to say, because aside from the question of what is or is not obscene, the question constantly arises in all areas in which we are active of government attempts to shortcut the safeguards which the Supreme Court has placed around prosecutions of this type. That is either prior censorship or simply policemen walking into bookstores and tearing things off the shelves and throwing them on the street, instigating a general raid in an area where booksellers or magazine sellers are brought into court and charged with selling materials without any great, and no attempt to establish by legal action that the material is legally obscene, but just is obscene in the opinion of the policeman involved, or in the opinion of a private citizens group which calls upon the policeman to take such action, or which calls upon the mayor to establish a commission, such as we have in my hometown, New York. I understand you've had some problems with regard to that here in St. Paul also. But in New York City, the mayor has convened a group of clergymen and others to consider the question of obscenity in New York and to propose some action by the government to take. This group has issued various pronouncements on it. So far, I don't think that a statute has been passed particularly for the city. We do have state statutes regulating providing such materials to juveniles, although I believe that just recently, in effect, they have been invalidated by court decision. Very often, they're not content to use due process to have these matters adjudicated, but seek vigilante forms of pressure to enforce their morality upon the rest of society. And first of all, to get public officials to back them, because it's much easier to do these things if you have the support of the public authority. So that we have to deal with the matter on two levels. On one, the general educational level, perhaps to try to remove from people the fear that this is one of the great evils which society must have laws against, not to endorse in any way the publication of trash on any level of human discourse, but to try to convince society that the answer to the problem is in not just talking about higher standards, but in actually elevating the standards of taste to the point where this material becomes unprofitable and therefore is not produced.
That was Gordon K. Haskell, National Director of Membership and Development for the American Civil Liberties Union, speaking on the historical development of the ACLU position on censorship of obscenity. This is Lynn Kastner, Executive Director of the MCLU. And now Professor Edward Gerald, Professor of Journalism at the University of Minnesota, currently on leave, speaks on arguing for a position of moderation of the American Civil Liberties Union position. Professor Gerald.
I'm supposed to speak on the topic of factors that argue for moderation in the ACLU point of view. I speak on this topic in spite of the fact that I'm a loyal member of ACLU. One of the things that I like about the organization is that we can have our differences and yet can unite in the support of liberty, and the differences that I have are well under control. Perhaps my role here is to remind us that we're talking about society, preferably a sane and a stable society, rather than about some subdivision or some part of it. The ACLU official position says that the burden of proof ought to be on the government to show that any communication with which it wishes to interfere will produce in the individuals who receive it a criminal act. And it seems to me that it's worthwhile to say that as a guide to the effect of communication, science arrived on the scene only recently, and it is not adequate to the task or competent to do the job that the ACLU would impose upon it. In fact, I regard this statement as arising in the adversary context of the ACLU's legal approach to the problem. It is a game which is being played to put those of us who believe in moderation on the defensive. I hope that I can convince you that we shouldn't adopt that defensive attitude. And as far as law becoming the basic matrix of the mores, I feel that we all know that the mores were here first and that law has to occupy a secondary position. The information I hope to convey is that men have had to solve the problems arising from pornographic communication as best they could, without substantial aid from either science or law. Such wisdom as our civilization brings forward from its historical experience dictates special precautions with reference to pornography. More than 50 nations have entered into a compact to restrict and control the flow of communication that is sexually violent, that pictures and teaches the sensual, loveless, carnal rites of sexual intercourse as casually and as carefully as we teach our children to brush their teeth. All of the 50 states have laws that permit the legal examination of materials after publication to determine their fitness under the Constitution for general circulation. And certainly all I could advocate here would be examination prior, post-publication examination. I don't think that any of us has ever argued that the censor should sit down with the author and decide what can be published. In opposition to this evidence of historical wisdom, which has been accumulated through the trial and error experience of several civilizations over hundreds of years, we find pitted two forces. That is, we find arrayed in opposition two forces. First, the commercial purveyors of dirt for dirt's sake, the debasers for money of the ideal of love, and second, liberal spirits who, like ourselves, in enthusiasm for our own maturity and in confidence in our own self-discipline, imagine all families to be as well nourished, as well sheltered, instructed, loved, and controlled as our own, and thus always able to find the information and understanding needed to harness and contain the sex drive. Our liberal idea is that we can carry on an educational dialogue with dirt so that our children can be brought safely to maturity, and that in maturity, no person will have a prurient interest in sex or hardcore pornography. Against this liberal ideal, let us place the facts about the nature of our society, which are current in the discipline of sociology. I select a diagram here from Robert Cooley Angel's Free Society and Moral Crisis to demonstrate the nature of systematic study of social control. Now, Professor Cooley is a famous sociologist. He's a systematic student. The presence of the word moral in the title of his book arises from the fact that parents and significant other persons build moral norms into children in an effort to monitor behavior. The term moral norms arises descriptively from the conscience thus created. The pattern of moral behavior is derived in substantial part from the common values of the society, which are held in a loose but in effective consensus. So this diagram shows you the origin of all of our control system is the common values of the society. The ways in which we effectuate or in which we apply the sanctions dictated to us by these common values are through the moral norms. On the one hand, these are inculcated, these are internalized by the child through the teachings of the parents and significant others. Then institutions on the right hand, which have an existence of their own, an influence over the individual quite of their own. And then in the middle is law. Now, these three enforcing agencies provide social control, and it's in this context that I wish to speak. The pattern of moral behavior is derived in substantial part, let me repeat, from the common values of the society, which are held in a loose but effective consensus. And I don't think that the official statement of the ACLU is directed as clearly and as hopefully as it should be directed towards the maintenance of those common values. If you notice, when one reaches too far to the left in deviation from moral norms, he is considered a deviant. He is considered a person who has a special problem, a dangerous problem. He may even become a danger to society. On the other hand, the person who becomes disloyal to institutions may find himself ostracized or exiled from that institution because he becomes a danger to that institution and its career. The law, on the other hand, is simply an enforcer of moral norms or of the rules of the institutions. Institutions such as the state, the professions, the church, the factory, the family, the voluntary association appropriate to their own purposes the lives of individuals who are caught up in them. We have lately seen in the court dock prominent corporation executives who doubtless would not cheat at golf, but who entered price collusion agreements that enabled them to steal from the general public in terms of millions of dollars. It is conflicts of this sort which we call upon law to help us handle, for law has to do the unpleasant work of reinforcing the discipline which, under our common values, is deemed necessary to a steady state. You can see from the diagram how Angel derives the concept of what is societally good on the one hand, and what is societally bad on the other hand. And this is a concept which we can all understand and we can all use. It's not a concept which is enforced by any religious dogma. It's a concept enforced by our own consciences and our knowledge of what is required to have a steady state. The society, that which is societally good contributes to a steady state. That which is societally bad contributes to the disintegration or the conflict or the breakup of the system, of the dynamic system which maintains that steady state. The steady state is one in which there is a high degree of correspondence between moral norms and behavior, when institutions and norms are compatible and adequate for control. When there is serious departure within society from moral norms, the phenomenon observed is deviation, as sexual deviation from the normative pattern, or as juvenile delinquency, or as extreme eccentricity in the mode of life. When there is a pattern of thought and action which tends to undermine institutions, we term the behavior as disloyalty, as an action which tends to undermine institutions. And thus, the person who plots the overthrow of the state by violence is termed disloyal. It's quite striking to me that in the pattern of the law, the Supreme Court has reached the same decision, for example, with reference to the Communist Party, that it's reached with reference to hardcore pornography. It has refused to allow the question to arise of whether or not the communist doctrine, the communist practice, has to result in overt acts before it allows interference, legal interference, with the organizational activities of the Communist Party. It is said that on the face of the evidence, they are conspiring to overthrow the government by force and by violence, and they've allowed interference with the political organization in violation, by the way, of the Constitution. And the same thing is true with reference to pornography. When they come to hardcore pornography, they draw a line which says, we will not wait for proof that this does produce overt criminal behavior. We will judge it on the basis of its tendency to do so. And by the way, the Supreme Court has rejected the clear and present danger test in dealing with pornography, just as it's rejected or restated it in dealing with the Communist Party in Dennis versus United States. The way our society treats hardcore pornography is explained by the fact that such communication is linked in common experience both to deviation and to disloyalty. It is a violent attack upon the moral norms, leading, according to historical wisdom, to disruptive or deviant behavior. It is subvention of such institutions as the family. The sick and unhealthy society is one in which the weight of deviant behavior tends to upset the balance between moral norms and institutions. Such behavior, in the angel's concept, is societally bad. Now, there are other important aspects of the diagram which we must ignore because of the shortage of time. We are concerned at the moment mainly with the normative value system. And so you might turn it off, Lynn, if you will, please. In the present state of social science, it is not possible to study definitively the elements of the moral web as we have described them here, and to determine precisely the effect of violent pornographic communication on our common life. This deficiency in science should not be read as an omen favorable to pornography. The latest literature on the general effects of communication, inadequate as it is, clearly supports the theory that damage occurs from pornography and that it is sufficiently grave that we are justified in providing calculated controls. We know that violence communicated by film or print triggers violence in frustrated children. We know that a child who enjoys a warm and solid home and a stable peer group relationship and who has no direct inheritance of mental illness is not likely to be affected by violent communication, as is the child who is significantly deprived. We know these things. The present state of constitutional law agrees with the theory of dangerous communication and asserts the necessity of control. Let me give you the short and simple case history of a pornographic communication. The doctrine of Queen versus Hicklin, 1868, a British case, was followed in this country until about 1933. It made children and deviant adults the standard by which to judge their probable effects of pornographic communication. This standard was abandoned in a series of cases beginning in 1933, and pornography was thereby divided into two classes. The first class, obscene communication, which children and normal adults in a healthy society must learn to live with, must learn to handle without stress, without serious stress. And second, hardcore pornography, deemed too violent in character to be tolerated and very unlikely to provide any lesson, any social lesson needed by the human heart. The new standard has been made national in scope, taking precedence over local law. All of us are exposed as a consequence to a swelling tide of obscene and pornographic communication, not necessarily the kind that can be stopped under the Constitution as presently interpreted. But this communication I'm talking to you about now, of the first class, was illegal in our country before 1933. And it is now protected by the Constitution. So there has been a very real liberalization of the Constitution. And we parents, we normal adults, are told that the Constitution newly places upon us the burden of preparing ourselves and our children for maturity more rapidly, more completely than ever before. We're told that rare and lovely art, which conveys a message of life worth learning, is sometimes found amid dirt, and that when seen in scabrous surroundings, it is made more significant by contrast by the unexpectedness of the discovery. The new national standard has left the moral norms of a great many persons uncovered, that is, unprotected by law. As a consequence, there is a considerable new private activity for the restoration of social controls. This is as it should be, for as long as private effort proceeds according to law, it is in itself a sign of a healthy state. The state must keep its institutions in repair. When those at the top impose standards unacceptable or inacceptable to those below, those which are in conflict with the common values, there must be a reconciliation. I doubt that the present directors of the American Civil Liberties Union correctly perceive the contemporary situation with respect to obscenity. As I repeat, I think they're playing an adversary game at law with the definitions involved here. It seems to me that the ACLU fought so long and valiantly against the doctrine of Queen versus Hicklin that it has not properly evaluated the changes resulting from nationalization of liberal values expressed in the Roth and Alberts decisions. It appears to feel that the law has not changed. The law has changed, and so has our society as a consequence. We're all on the defensive now. It seems to me that by adopting an absolutist position, ACLU shirks an obligation to work for a reconciliation of the community's historical experience and the new constitutional libertarianism. The burden of facing all the facts with respect to social control should not be placed on sociologists, and will not so long as juries in our local communities are permitted to evaluate the effect of pornographic communication. I prefer to stick, for the time being, to the historical evidence as interpreted by the local juries, and to place the burden of proof about the serendipity of pornography on adherents of this new libertarian school.
That was Professor Edward Gerald, Professor of Journalism at the University of Minnesota, currently on leave, speaking on arguing for a position of moderation of the ACLU stand on censorship of obscenity. This is Lynn Kastner, Executive Director of the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union. I think it is clear from some of the remarks of Professor Gerald, from some of the issues raised by our speakers on this topic, that one of the very important questions involved in the policy behind or the need for society to remove offensive materials is that it adversely affects the minds and the actions of young people. I think it is to this question appropriate to hear from Dr. Reynold Jensen, Director of Psychiatry of the University of Minnesota Hospitals, who will on the next program discuss the cause and effect relationship, if any, between reading of offensive materials or allegedly obscene materials and antisocial behavior in children. If you would like more information on these programs, or if you wish to comment or question the materials you've heard on these programs, we invite you to send your inquiries and comments to the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union, Upper Midwest Building, Minneapolis, Minnesota. Also, if you would like our brochure from the American Civil Liberties Union on obscenity and censorship, send your name and address to MCLU, Upper Midwest Building, Minneapolis, Minnesota. This has been the 12th in a series of civil liberties educational programs produced as a public service by the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union.